It's 8:15 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. In the studio with me now, Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's pick up where the Rick Bruff story left off, and that is the sales tax distribution of the Epic Pass. Things sound like it kind of fell through the cracks here. Just we had a task force and then never did anything with it?
No, I don't think that's quite accurate. We had a task forces. That one was really meetings that we scheduled with Park City and Summit County to discuss just general interactions with Vail, because we knew that when Vail came in, there was going to be a lot of activity. There was the gondola activity. There's, you know, at some point there's going to be base development activity. And it was a means of Park City and Summit County kind of coordinating to make sure that we were each aware of what the other was doing and what was being asked of it, so that we were sort of coordinating it. And the sales tax issue was one of those issues. We didn't get it very far down the road at that time. I think we're going to have to pick it up again and figure out exactly how we're going to do it. We've got one season under our belts, so we'll at least be able to see how it was allocated last year. And it can get a little bit complicated. Under Utah law, Utah assesses sales taxes based on a point of sale, but then they also look at the first use. To determine the point of sale, you look at where it's first used. So somebody could theoretically buy an Epic Pass from the Canyons, use it for the first time at Park City, and Park City would be deemed the point of sale for that particular pass. Now we've got a gondola connecting the two resorts. So you could buy your pass at Park City, you could ski the first time at the Canyons, but also ski a few runs at Park City, and it becomes less clear. So the Epic Pass, the connection, it all kind of muddies the water a little bit more. So I think we really do have to get our arms around the issue now.
Yeah, so some kind of campaigning going on. I mean, that's what there was some talk about. It's like, oh, let's, you know, Park City Municipal buys donuts and maybe bagels over at the Canyons just to see, to get them there, right?
Yeah, I don't think we're quite there yet. I think our entities work pretty well together these days, so I think we'll be able to figure it out. And then it gets more complicated when you consider that I think you can buy an Epic Pass online. So are you theoretically buying it in Colorado at that point from the headquarters? And if you are, then we've got state agreements in place between Utah and Colorado as to how sales taxes are allocated. So it's a much larger issue than simply where somebody skis for the first time.
So it's, again, I mean, because most of the passes are bought online, no? And so does that mean it's going to Broomfield, Colorado?
I don't know the answer. Again, I think we have to look and see how the taxes were assessed this year to figure that out.
All right. So things could change because you don't have the that three-way agreement in place yet?
Correct.
All right. Let's have a look. You had a report from your fair coordinator, Travis English. What about a new site? I mean, is the goal to have something in time for next year's fair?
No, I think that's very ambitious. I mean, if we buy a new site, we're going to have to get the land. We're going to have to do a lot of work on the land. We're going to have to figure out exactly what we want to construct there. I mean, they're going to be, I assume, some permanent fair facilities, where we want to position them, what we need. I mean, we're going to have to do more investigations to figure out exactly what can be handled at the site and what we'd like to do. I mean, if we're going to make that kind of an investment, I don't think it's going to be for a 10-day event once a year. I think it's going to be something that's going to be broader, that the communities, certainly on the east side of the county, if that's where it winds up being, can use on a regular basis, whether it's for horse events, rodeo events, something on an ongoing basis, so that we're not just buying a large parcel and furnishing it with facilities for an event that occurs over a 10-day period.
Yeah. Is that the commitment from the county council, though, to at least keep it on the north end of the county?
I think we'd like to do that. I think most of the people in the county would like that. Historically, it's been there. I think it's, you know, when you look at some of the eastern Summit County communities, economically, they've had a tough time, you know, with historically when oil and gas sort of went away, particularly gas went away in on the Chalk Creek area and the boom died out. Colville's had a tough time, you know, getting a foothold. And I think it's probably not responsible of us to take away something that is a good economic driver for that part of the county because of the agricultural facilities and activities that go on there, the livestock shows, the rodeos, the things that are very much a part of that fabric. You know, you can make arguments for moving it to the Snyderville Basin, I suppose, but I think it belongs there.
How big of a parcel do you need?
I don't remember what they told us. I think we need something in the neighborhood of, I'll get it wrong, but I think it's 60 acres, 60 or 70 acres.
Do you have any idea what you've got now?
Substantially less than what we need. We don't have that much, and the available expansion area would be up around the high school, and it would separate it from the existing fairgrounds, and it just doesn't work for us. Plus, we've got the lovely mink farm right next door that, you know, adds to the event.
All right. Spend some time also on transportation planning. You listen to both Caroline Ferris and Alfred Knotts talk about the short-range plans, long-range plans, the various transit committee advisory groups, the public input sessions, work sessions. Hard to kind of keep it all together. But for the public, I mean, what do you think are the most important dates? Any deadlines coming up?
Yeah, I think actually from what Alfred was telling us, I believe that they're going to be having some community discussions probably in late October, November. That will be coming up for some of the work that Park City is doing on, parking issues, on their short-range plan. We've got, Park City has engaged an organization out of, I think, Maryland and Austin, Texas. And I went to a meeting with those folks probably a month and a half ago, and they talked about, they've been in the community, they've been riding buses, they've been taking the various routes, they've been talking to passengers as they ride, collecting data. It's a purportedly a very good organization. They're good at what they do, and hopefully they'll come back with recommendations on how we can streamline our bus system and make some of the routes work better, which is something that I've been pushing for a while. The long-range transportation plan, Caroline hoped to have a draft by next September, September 2016, and the only thing I asked as I looked at the outline that they provided to the council, it's a very, very extensive outline with a lot of detail. And I said, let's just not get lost in the weeds. Let's make sure at the end of the day that we've got elements that can be implemented that are clear and straightforward. We know approximately what population growth is going to look like. We don't need four pages detailing that. So let's get down to the meat of it as quickly as we can.
All right. Well, when Park City Transportation Manager Alfred Knotts talked about looking for new parking areas in Park City, you said that may increase pressure on both Highways 224 and 248. Can you expand on that?
Sure. I think, it's intuitively, and Tim Henney has talked about this. We've had, in some of our joint meetings, we've had extensive conversations about parking. If you make free parking widely available, people will use it. That means they're going to drive their cars in because it's easy. If you restrict parking, then they've got to find another alternative. If it costs $50 to park, people are going to look for another alternative because that's a pain. And we see that happen at Sundance and during other special events. It's a bit of a catch-22 because we can't make parking punitive. We can't start reducing parking. We can't make it difficult for people to use their cars unless and until we've provided a great alternative for them. But once we do that, then I think we need to make sure that we're trying to use every kind of incentive that we can think of to have people use the excellent new transportation that we provide.
So you've often advocated putting in what are called intercept lots outside of the city, kind of to catch the traffic before it comes in. Given that, I mean, what was your reaction to the Breckenridge approach?
I was surprised. I mean, the idea that they felt that it was better to bring the traffic into the city center and park them there and then deal with the outflow, which is problematic for 22 or 23 days a year. They know they're going to have terrible traffic, and they just have adjusted their psychology to say, okay, these are going to be the awful traffic days. They assign police officers to direct traffic to help people get out of town, so those resources are going to help move cars. And I was surprised that they chose that approach. I think Vail liked the approach. They helped, build one of the parking facilities. Vail has been a good partner, actually, with Breckenridge in terms of parking and moving people around. And they do it pretty well. But I think that's not the right solution for us.
Yeah, in Breckenridge, we had heard from at least one local business person who didn't think it helped some to have intercept slots. I mean, he said that a visitor goes to the outside lot, buses into town to their event or activity, then bus back, and then they leave town, and then you don't have any other interaction with that customer.
It's an interesting thought. I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, if, there are, we go to, my wife and I go to concert events and other events, and we find ourselves waiting until the traffic dissipates before we leave, and you can always find something to do. So again, I think human behavior adjusts, and to get on for several thousand people to get on a bus all at the same time. It might be easier just to go grab a bite to eat and have a beer and wait for the traffic to dissipate and then make your way back to your car.
All right. You also had gotten news yesterday about the Be Wise Energize program that you had high hopes for. This would have provided low interest loans to people to weatherize their house. Basically, the county couldn't fiscally make loans for energy efficiency projects because there's already programs out there doing it better, huh?
I think that's exactly right. And each time that this was brought before council, we kept asking the same questions. How's it going to be administered? What's it going to cost? And how much are the loans at the end of the day going to cost consumers? Because we're competing with home improvement loans. I mean, there are a variety of loans available to consumers. How does this make sense for us to do it? And when they really started digging in, it just was not financially feasible to do it. The administrative costs plus the loan servicing fees, had we tried to do it in-house, would have been much, much higher than they could get in the private sector. It's still a good thing to do, and I think we're going to help market it. Summit County Power Works, I think, is pushing that as an incentive. As you know, we're in the lead right now for the Georgetown Prize. It's $5 million for this community if we can win that. And for us to be able to do it means that our citizens all have to pull together and make that happen. Weatherization is good for us for that competition, and it's also good for homeowners. And anything that we can do to reduce the amount of airflow that comes in and out of our houses, to seal things up, to keep it warmer, to insulate, to weatherize our homes. We've got a lot of old homes in the county, and it's an opportunity to do it. So I think Lisa, through her explorations, and Mary Krista, I think they've got some idea as to what kind of resources are available out there. And I'd like to help us find a way to help market not only that it's a good thing for us to do as members of the community, but also that here are some of the resources that you can look to without endorsing any specific one, but just to help point people in the right direction.
Yeah. Did you set a budget amount for it or?
Not yet. No, we just got the report yesterday, but we're going into budget season now. I don't think it's got to be, you know, a gigantic amount of money.
All right. And then with regard to the Mountain Accord agreement, you were the only dissenter on the vote yesterday. How come?
I find myself in that position more and more regularly. You know, the Mountain Accord, when it started out, was a transportation initiative. And over time, at some point midway through the process, it switched to a recreation and environment initiative, maybe the other way around, environment and recreation, with transportation being the component that's supposed to facilitate the other elements. And when the Accord process was put together, UTA was set up as the primary administrator for the Accord process. And they oversaw the program manager and other elements. And so as we were winding up and getting toward signing the Accord, we had discussions about whether it was appropriate for UTA to continue on in that seat, and it was decided that it was not by the executive board. So they set about trying to find an alternative, and they came up with the Wasatch Front Regional Council. I didn't know what that was when it came before council. I asked. It's a transportation, I believe, based on the explanation yesterday, it looks at regional transportation along the Wasatch Front. And the guy who is the executive director of that organization is one of the guys that facilitated most of the Transportation System Committee meetings that I attended. And I had concerns about how those meetings were held. I had concerns about the results of those meetings, the actual output at the end of the day. And it just didn't seem appropriate to, again, if we're changing from UTA to something else to emphasize the recreation and environment, perhaps that's not the best to be in that seat. My other council members disagreed, and there we are.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
That's it.
All right. Roger, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Take care.
Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. 8:30 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, Park City teacher Heidi Matthews is one of the candidates running for president of the Utah Education Association. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why?
Why? Well, I have to admit, I didn't wake up one morning and say, sign me up for UEA president. It kind of crept up on me. Being a local leader in Park City here quite a few years ago, I ended up kind of expanding into state leadership and now serve on the NEA board. So I travel to D.C. And I just feel like as a teacher, we have a special responsibility to fulfill the promise of education for our kids, and I have become hooked on this work and the association.
All right, so you're one of how many candidates for the position?
Currently, there are three, but the primary election won't be held until February, actually. So there may be more along the way.
Is the incumbent running?
No, the current president, Sharon Gallagher Fishbaugh, will be finishing her term. The vice president, however, is a candidate for the position.
All right. And is there a term limit on it?
Yes, it's a 3-year term, and you can be reelected for a second term. So 6 years total is the max.
All right. So what happens? I mean, it's you just sign up and then start campaigning? I mean, Who's voting for you?
Well, the election it's a statewide election, so all the members of the Utah Education Association will be able to vote. So it's about 15,000 members in the association across the state. We will be campaigning at the convention that's coming up here. I'll be visiting the local associations throughout the state in the next few months into January and talking about, you know, what's important for our association, our cause, and how I'm the person to hopefully lead them.
Yeah. So basically, teachers, administrators, I don't know, do the licensed or classified folks also pay dues into the Utah Education Association? Or
No, in Utah, we're kind of a unique entity in that we have a licensed and a classified association. So we have two entities. They're both affiliated with the National Education Association, but they're not at the state level.
So is it a choice by a teacher whether or not to join the Utah Education?
It is. In Utah, it is. We're being a right-to-work state. They do have a choice of membership. Fortunately, in Park City, we have quite possibly the highest membership in the state. We're at about 80% of our licensed teachers who have chosen to belong.
All right. So why do you think you make a good candidate?
Well, I've got the experience being a local leader and being serving on the board of the UEA. I've got the commitment. I've just really turned into I don't know, maybe an addict for association work is probably the best term. I just really believe in the power of education, and that the association is really an integral, essential voice for teachers to be involved in anything having to do with education decisions, policy, legislation, professional advocacy.
Yeah. So what is it that as a president of the Utah Education Association, what would you do?
Well, we would lead the way in terms of establishing the association direction with, you know, what avenues of professional support we want to have, looking at accountability measures and what we can do to support teachers in their classrooms with assessment, literacy, learning how to use data to help instruction, so that professional advocacy. Also develop partnerships with legislatures, the governors, and hopefully influence policy.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, though, I'm guessing, is between the UEA and the state legislature.
Yes,
every year.
And the state school board.
What, all having different, I mean, do you align more with the state school board or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, no. The state school board enacts what the legislature does. And so hopefully, you know, being persuasive at the legislative, I'm losing my words here, at that level helps in terms of determining the rule and how it's enacted later on.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So in the meantime, Utah Education Association hosting its annual conference next week, and it's the time of year that many of us see as a great long weekend and head to Southern Utah. it's a 2-day school holiday.
Right. Yeah. It didn't used to be. Back in the day, this was a day where all educators in Utah was a professional day, and so they would all attend the conference. But yeah, I know most people are saying, "What are you doing for UEA?" And it's like, "Oh, I do UEA on UEA." It's actually a pretty awesome exposition conference.
Are teachers required to go then? No.
No, no. It is optional. And it's not just open, it's not just for teachers. It's actually open to the public and students, kids, anyone who is welcome to go. It has some workshops and keynote speakers and booths and book giveaways and all sorts of exciting things having to do with education.
Yeah, so is it just Thursday, Friday?
It's Thursday, Friday.
Mm-hmm. And it takes place where?
It's at the Sandy Exposition Center. At 9:30 on Thursday, Becky Pringle, who is the Vice President of the National Education Association, will be delivering a keynote address, which I think will be really exciting. And then at 2 o'clock on Thursday, there will be an education policy panel with Speaker Greg Hughes and Senator Jim DeBacus, along with our UEA President Sharon Gallagher-Fischbach and Becky Pringles. So that will be a great event.
Yeah. So when you talk about kind of exhibitions, I mean, those feature what? The newest and best in education?
There's all sorts of vendors. There'll be people that are looking for different benefits and things for educators, you know, insurance, that kind of thing. But also all sorts of vendors, books and computer programs, robotics, giveaways, information, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, so as we are talking about building new schools here in Park City, I mean, are there people there that, you know, talk about the future of what a new school looks like?
You know, new schools, I wouldn't say so much, but definitely the future of education in terms of what we can do to begin to make this enticing for our best and brightest students going into, hopefully encouraging them to go into education. I know that there are a lot of colleges and graduate programs and things who will have booths there. National Board Certification will have some information there for people to better their practices. Not so sure about, you know, school building, but certainly programs and education opportunities.
Yeah, you know, I sat through a panel at this FIRE conference yesterday talking about education, and really what they talked about, it was so cool because there was a science fiction writer mm-hmm. there, and he was asking these experts of education, you know, so where are we going to be in 10 years? I mean, just because he wants to, you know, then put it in his book. But really, what they stand for is this whole notion of project-based learning, what we're seeing in the PC CAPS building. And the way they explained it is that teachers, instead of kind of ruling the class or mm-hmm. controlling the classroom, is that teachers need to learn to become coaches, because what we've got is a team, and that all of the students now are players on that team. And how is it that the coach, a good coach, gets the best out of, you know, each of his or her, you know, players on the team? So, I mean, is that how you see it?
Is that the future? Absolutely. And I think it's really exciting. I think that there is a fine balance, though, between a project-based learning and having some background knowledge that allows that to be a full and rich experience. And you can't just turn kids loose and expect them to, you know, be learning on their own with some coaching. There is some groundwork that needs to be laid, and curiosity that's sparked that lays the groundwork. And also focusing on, you know, equal opportunities for our students. They're not all coming in on the same playing field, you know, that making sure that people are fed and that they have exposure to all sorts of experiences.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, that was something that got raised. I mean, why do we care that kids know what the state capitals are? I mean, certainly it's, in, you know, important that, you know, that you live in Utah, that, you know, that Salt Lake City's the capital. But why is it? I mean,
I think just having a base of a knowledge base to be moving forward is essential in as an educated citizen.
Certainly. But, you know, we all, most of us will be carrying around our portable, you know, phones, our portable computers, basically. If we want to know what the capital is of South Dakota, I mean, we can ask our phone.
Sure, sure. But then as the questions become much more complex, we need to be able to ask these devices much more sophisticated questions and then be able to assess that information to make sure that it's accurate and that it's being posted or being presented by someone who has the credentials to be able to say that with authenticity. And that's a skill that I think our students really, really need, is that sort of that judgment and that branching out that we don't necessarily see in just the traditional classroom.
Okay. Anyway, so the election is February what? Is it one day or is it go over?
No, it's an online voting for UEA members, and the primary election will be 3 weeks in February, and then if I'm successful there, it'll be into April.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you very
much. Thanks for coming in. That's Park City teacher Heidi Matthews, also a candidate for the Utah Education Association presidency. KPCW News Time now, 8:43. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. The debate over rooftop solar now entering round two as state utility regulators, Rocky Mountain Power, and solar advocates examine the cost and benefits that rooftop solar brings to the state. The issue will be open for public comment at a public hearing this evening, 5 o'clock at the Heber Wells Building in Salt Lake City. In the studio with me to tell us their case of why the Public Service Commission should grant Rocky Mountain Power its request for a surcharge on solar panels, I have company spokesman Paul Murphy along with Chad Ambrose. He's the Rocky Mountain Power's regional business manager. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So the meeting again at Heber Wells Building, 160 East, 300 South at 5 p.m. What is Rocky Mountain Power, Paul, asking the Public Service Commission for specifically?
We basically asked the commission to look at the facts. We've been studying and looking at how much it costs to provide electricity to rooftop solar customers. And we've decided, and the way the rates are set up right now is right now rooftop solar customers are being subsidized by those who don't have solar power. You'd think that Rocky Mountain Power actually doesn't have a dog in this fight, because we won't make any more money regardless of what the decision is made. What we're trying to do is protect our customers who don't have solar power and right now have no choice but to subsidize those who do.
So you'll be reducing the fees then for those who don't have solar panels if you're not going to make any more money?
Right. The rates would go down slightly for all customers. And so this is an issue of fairness for all customers. If you do choose to have rooftop solar, we think it's fair that you pay the prices for it.
So how have you determined that those of us with rooftop solar are not paying our fair share?
We have been studying it. We've been putting special meters on people who do have rooftop solar. We've been looking at just the model of what it costs exactly to provide electricity to these customers. We provided that evidence to the commission, and we hope that they will make a decision based on the facts and not on emotion.
Yeah. There's a minimum monthly charge of about $9 a month. And so you're saying that that's not enough?
It's actually about $5. And for the actual cost, the fixed cost for the poles and the wires, it's truly about $25. In Wyoming, customers are charged a $20 basic fee charge. So if that was the case, then this really wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah. At the same time, though, for those who have larger solar arrays, you're actually getting free energy from them. So
We are not getting free energy from
why
them.
You say
we,
that?
We actually do pay them the retail rate for that electricity. It's electricity we could actually get from other sources at a cheaper price, but right now we're required to pay the full retail rate of that electricity.
My understanding is that that's not the case, because there's a year through your net metering agreement that you have a year. So say you have an array that, you know, generates more energy than the household actually used. After a year, that goes to Rocky Mountain Power, and there's no check handed over to the homeowner.
Right, and that's why we recommend that people build solar arrays that fit their needs, not to build excess power. But Rocky Mountain Power actually doesn't benefit from it. We actually give it to low-income customers. So we take that electricity and give credits to low-income households.
Yeah, but you're not paying anybody for that additional electricity.
Not that additional, and
not at your cost.
Not at our cost, and the truth is, we don't want them to produce more than they use. We think that people should, they are not actually helping the system.
So let's talk about that, because you would think that, in fact, those with solar panels are helping the system, because it's pushing off your capital needs of having to install more transformers, which are probably some of the most expensive parts of generating electricity, right?
Well, Rocky Mountain Power has to build a pipe for the peak. So it's kind of like water pressure. You need to have pipes big enough to handle the most pressure that's used. And so if people are actually just reducing their energy use, they are helping to keep us from building additional plants. But with solar power, when the sun goes up, they're producing a lot of electricity. But when the sun goes down, that's actually the peak time during the evenings. We still have to produce enough electricity during those evening hours.
I can just add one thing as well, Paul. Whether a customer is generating or they're using electricity, there is a power flow that's occurring on the system. So if they're over-generating, meaning they're not using as much as they're generating, that generation is flowing on to the utilities system. And the system needs to be built to be able to meet those needs.
So opponents of the surcharge point out that a similar charge was imposed in Arizona. And after that, the number of solar installations dropped dramatically. I mean, that's in one of the most sunny states of the country. I mean, it sounds like you do that here and we're going to see the same thing happen in Utah. Why would that be a good thing?
Well, I've actually talked to my counterparts in Arizona, and there was a big rush to build as many solar panels as possible before certain tax credits and certain other credits went away. But my understanding now is that the solar industry is thriving in Arizona. It's doing just as good as it was. It's just that they aren't getting all the subsidies they were getting before. They added a small fee to rooftop solar customers, and my understanding is they're still doing booming business.
So how much of a charge are we talking about? It would go from $5 a month to how much?
Actually, we're leaving that up to the commission. We want them to decide what a fair price would be, fair to the rooftop solar customers and fair to the rest of our customers.
Yeah. Last year, the Public Service Commission denied the request for that fee, saying that it couldn't rule that the fee was justified, told you to go back and analyze the data. So what's changed between then and now?
What's changed is that we've provided the data, and the groups that oppose any changes in the subsidy have not provided the data. And the testimony so far this week is they have rejected their experts, the environmentalist experts, saying that they have not provided any relevant information that shows what they are trying to prove.
So the public hearing then happens tonight, just this one opportunity, or people can also email their comments? Do you know?
Actually, people have been emailing and mailing in their comments for a long period of time, for the entire past year. And so the commission has received a lot of information.
Leslie, maybe I could just say one thing as well. The gist of this hearing, the whole center of it is around what is the value of solar, right? So not necessarily rate design at this point as much as it is what is the value of solar. And just as Paul has alluded to, the environmental groups have been able to provide their position. The utility has provided its position. So it's been a concerted effort really of all stakeholders to come together and to determine what that is. And as Paul says, Public Service Commission will ultimately decide what that value is.
Mm-hmm. Still, I mean, it just seems so disingenuous. You know, it's like, well, you guys aren't getting the, you know, when I'm not paying a $75 electricity bill anymore, that's got to be cutting into your profits. So it's like, well, let's charge her more and say that we're, you know, for renewable energies when in fact you're.
Well, the truth is, regardless, we have to provide the infrastructure. We have to spend billions of dollars to provide poles, wires, generating plants for when the sun isn't shining and when the wind isn't blowing. And so all that infrastructure has to be paid for somehow. And so if it's not there, then the rooftop solar customers will not have the energy they need during the evenings and during the night.
Yeah, but it's not going to be too far off, based on what I've been hearing at this technology conference, where we have our own batteries and that our panels are going to be able just to store these, what are they, you know, like a Tesla battery, you know? And, you know, we have one or two of these, and it's like, we don't need you anymore. So
yeah, and when that day comes, they will not need to be hooked to the grid. And so right now, we are their battery, and we're a very inexpensive battery. And so when the day comes when they can have their own batteries, this won't be an issue at all.
So are you guys planning for that?
We are.
How? I mean, what, diversifying the company?
Actually, Chad knows a little bit more about that than I do.
Well, the fact is just as Paul has said, we have to meet our system peak, whether customers are generating or not. We have to have the generation in place. The fact is, and Leslie, you're right, as batteries come on, it will be a game changer. However, today the costs are very prohibitive for most customers to be able to cut the wire and say, I'm going to be off the grid and rely wholly upon solar and battery. The costs are just too prohibitive. As the day comes, you will see the utility industry needing to adapt. And I can tell you we will and we are.
All right. And Chad, you said that you could address this, I mean, to the topic of why it's taking so long to get solar panels hooked onto the grid. We've got a couple of large arrays here that haven't been hooked up in months. The panels there at Park City Mark and at the Summit County Justice Center. It also took months to get the Utah Olympic Oval onto the grid. How come?
Yeah, so I can tell you a little bit about it. As a utility, we operate under national standards. Right, we have this thing called the IEEE. It's the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And we use a section called 1547 that was part of the Energy Policy Act, I believe, of 2005 that Bush put into play. And that standard became industry-wide. We operate under that standard for distributed generation. As part of that standard, there are several subchapters. We focus on Chapter 7 as it relates to distributed generation. What that means is we operate a utility that is a four-wire system. And to the standard customer, they may not care really what that means. But really, it's three phases, A, B, and C, plus a neutral. And that neutral provides us a ground. And when the system is operating normal, the neutral has very low voltage on it. However, if we have a fault on the system and if there's no grounding, a fault would be like a tree, you know, falling into a power line, something like that, or lightning strike. When that occurs, you have overvoltage occurring on the other two phases and it damages equipment. So the equipment needs to be grounded. Where I'm going is this. The Mark, for example, and also the Justice Center and the Oval, all required what is called effective grounding under this IEEE standard that I alluded to. Effective grounding does have a lead time about it, and it requires additional engineering. And what that effective grounding does is it grounds the system after the inverter. So once it's been converted from direct current to alternating current, it protects the system.
So who pays for that? I mean, that just it's not the person who's put the solar panels on, huh?
Well, it is, actually. Oh. Yeah, so what happens is the installer will put in an application with Rocky Mountain Power. We will review the application, and then we'll determine whether or not effective grounding is required. And it's really driven by the amount of usage that's taking place on a distribution circuit, a lot like your home. You've got a lot of circuits coming out of your breaker panel. If one's lightly loaded and you inject a source of generation onto it, it creates a voltage imbalance to the system, and it needs to be grounded. So that's really what it boils down to with those big projects.
So when will the Mark come online?
Yeah, the Mark. Exciting. The Mark comes on either tomorrow or Monday. It should come online, and then the Justice Center is right there with it.
Okay, so we've got the effective grounding problem
solved. It is resolved, yes.
Well, I'll also ask you, you know, Heber... in Heber City, they've got Heber Power and Light.
Right.
They're their own utility?
Yes.
So you have nothing to do with them? Other than they get to use some of your grid, right?
We have, what we provide is transmission service to municipally owned utilities, which Heber Light and Power would be. So transmission is basically from the generator along our transmission system to a substation from which they take the service.
So is that kind of the wave of the future where we're going to see municipalities building, you know, large solar farms or wind farms and then just becoming their own utility company? I mean, is that possible?
I don't see it occurring regularly. We've seen it happen over the years. However, the infrastructure costs to become a utility and the ability to maintain the system from generation to point of delivery are extremely expensive. That's why you've got these large utilities that have the capital, and frankly, they're fully regulated.
Yeah. You know, and I guess it's hard. I mean, certainly you guys get the brunt of it. It's like our power goes out, and it's like, when's the power going to come on? But at the same time, you guys are a monopoly and making just, you know, giant corporate profits. And so there's just, it's hard to, we want to criticize you, but at the same time, I guess we're grateful for what you do.
Well, and that's a perception. I mean, we are regulated by the state, and they actually determine what sort of profits we make, and they have to make sure that it is fair and it's reasonable. So we have to justify every penny we spend and whether we're even compensated for those investments we make. And so we're rate regulated, and they determine whether we make any sort of profits at all.
So when's the PSC going to make a decision? Any idea?
I have no idea. I hope sooner rather than later.
So is tonight the final chance to give comment on this issue?
It is. Tonight would be the chance for people to speak in public and in person with the commission.
All right. Anything else you two wanted to add?
No, I would just add, we truly appreciate the opportunity to serve Park City and Summit County. It's a great relationship, and you guys are just, you're great people, and we appreciate it.
And you got all your work done, it looks like, with the substation there in
the Park City side, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
We're doing a lot of permitting work on the Eastern Summit County side right now.
Yeah, you were here for a while. Great. Paul and Chad, thanks for coming in this morning.
Good to see you.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.